Walter, nice to have you here.
It's good to be here.
I just explained to the audience, you're a kid from New Jersey and being inspired by Duke Ellington?
Well, the way that came about was I think I'm very lucky in that my parents, even though they were not musicians themselves, were music lovers of a very high degree. And in my house growing up, I heard everybody played on the record player from Duke Ellington to John Coltrane to Hank Williams to Elvis Presley to Bill Monroe to Ella Fitzgerald. Every kind of music was played by my parents.
And it's all the music in the world almost.
Yeah, and when I was a little boy, they started taking me to see concerts. And, you know, my mother took me to see James Brown and Ray Charles. And many times we went to see Duke Ellington, Ella Fitzgerald, Count Basie, people like that. My father used to take me to black jazz clubs in Atlantic City to hear jazz acts. And we'd be the only white people in the club, and they would treat us just great, yeah, and make us feel great, and we were there for the music. And at an early age, I think around six, I started studying the trumpet, and I was going to be a jazz trumpeter. And for my 10th birthday, my mother arranged that I spend the afternoon in a theater in New Jersey with Duke Ellington and his orchestra.
That was a birthday gift?
That was a birthday gift. They were playing down the street in a theater, when, you know, in the next town. And my mother went there early in the day, and the orchestra was in there setting up. And she went in and said, "Mr. Ellington, my son is 10 years old today, and he's a big fan. And is there any chance if I bring him down, you would say hello?" He said, "Go get him. Bring him over." And I ended up spending the whole day there and the evening with him and his orchestra hanging out. And they sort of befriended me. And as we say, they took me under their wing. And I think they thought it was cool that there was a 10-year-old kid who wanted to play jazz trumpet. And
Did you really play with them?
I didn't play. I just hung out and talked. And they were all just incredibly friendly to me and humorous and warm. And it just blew my mind, especially Mr. Ellington, who sat down with me for a long time on a couch. And we discussed what I should expect if I wanted to become a musician when I grew up.
All right, you made it your mind. You made up your mind at that point. I want to be a musician. When did the switch from trumpet to guitar occurred?
Well, you know, right around the same time in the United States as that my meeting with Mr. Ellington, America was having a folk music boom, a folk music craze. And there were all these groups like Peter, Paul, and Mary and the Chad Mitchell Trio, and there was Bob Dylan coming out.
We're talking early 60s now, the end of the 50s?
61, yeah, 62. And I got caught up in the folk music thing, and I got an acoustic guitar and realized that if I just learned three chords, I could go to a party and I could play these folk songs for people, and we could all sing, and it would make me popular at the party. So I started learning my three chords and learning songs, you know, Michael Row the Boat Ashore and all that kind of stuff. And started just playing the guitar really for fun on the side. I still considered myself a trumpet player. And I studied the trumpet and really worked hard at it. And the guitar was just something for fun to do with my friends. And but I found it started coming to me very easy, the guitar. It just seemed really natural to me when I was playing it. Like, it was not difficult to do. And I started spending more and more time with the guitar than with the trumpet. And I started getting pretty good on the thing. And then a few years later, February 9th, 1964, was a big day in the United States for musicians of my age. And that is because that is the date that the Beatles appeared on Ed Sullivan on television. And 73 million people watched that show, and I was one of them. And I knew right then that the trumpet was a thing of the past. And that really, even though I loved jazz and loved listening to it, I realized that I wanted to play rock and roll, and that eventually turned into the blues.
But did you miss prisons like say, Carl Perkins, Chuck Berry, Buddy Holly, for instance? They were playing rock and roll before the Beatles, and the Beatles actually were greatly influenced by those guys.
Well, here's the thing, I do have to say, growing up in my house, my parents were also playing records by Jerry Lee Lewis and Little Richard. Little Richard was big in my house when I was a kid. But I think a lot of us in America at that time sort of took it for granted. It was everywhere. It was all around us. And what the Beatles did was sort of recycle it. Yeah. They took that American rock and roll music, they changed it around a little bit, and they presented it in their own way and added a little bit of melody to it, too. It wasn't just the 12-bar, three-chord rock and roll songs anymore.
It was the genius of the producer, George Martin, who put some like really melodic stuff in it.
But also it was the genius of their composing,
the
songs
course,
they composed, too. And they presented that music back to American kids in a different way, and they sort of showed us what was there all along. But it really changed many people of my generation who are musicians, all the guys in my band, for instance, they remember that show on Ed Sullivan as being a turning point in their life, and I'm one of them.
Isn't that the same thing that happened with the blues that came back from England with bands the likes of Led Zeppelin and
the Stones and
the Rolling Stones
and the Cream? That's true, you know. You know, I heard those records, and the Stones were doing songs by, you know, Bo Diddley and Howlin' Wolf. Yeah. And it made me want to go back and hear the originals. And that also happened with a lot of kids I knew back then, is we heard the Cream doing, you know.
Yeah, Crossroads, Robert Johnson songs.
Yeah, Robert Johnson songs and Howlin' Wolf tunes. And we went back and checked out the originals that had been there all along but had been taken for granted by
It's like by having it. Treasure Islands in your backyard.
Yeah, yeah. Sure.
by what moment did you get caught up with the blues?
I remember that one, too. That was my older brother, Ed, who introduced me to a lot of music, and I have thanked him on some of my CDs because I thought he was the coolest guy in the world. And when he'd bring home a John Coltrane record and say, listen to this, I sat down and listened. And one day he brought home a record by a group called the Paul Butterfield Blues Band with a guitar player named Michael Bloomfield. And I remember him saying, you got to hear this guy play the guitar. You know, you've never heard anything like this before. And he sat me down and he said, I'm going to play this record loud. He turned it up and I sat there, and I still remember the effect that had on me. All of a sudden, I knew what it was I was going to do for the rest of my life. I knew what kind of sound I wanted to make on the guitar. You know, and Michael Bloomfield's playing on that first album, which was from, I believe, 65, back when we were listening to guitar players like George Harrison and Keith Richards, and who were great players, but nothing like this guy. This guy mixed blues playing from the school of B.B. King and Buddy Guy and Albert King and guys like that. He mixed that kind of playing with rock and roll aggression and fire and technique. Mm. So he really blended the two. And he really was, to me, the first blues rock guitar player. And it was astounding back then to put that record on and hear him play. It was unbelievable.
But that moment you decided, I wanted to play the blues, I want to sound like him, then you got a big problem. Because where do you go from there?
Where you go from there is you start practicing a lot. Because if you want to try to play with that kind of technique and that kind of fire and that kind of passion, you better put a lot of hours into it. And that's what I realized. And that's when the trumpet completely got put away.
Did you ever play the trumpet on stage after that?
I did play the trumpet in school orchestras. And we did Beethoven, and we did Gershwin, and we did all that. And I was the lead trumpet player, and I was also in what's called a drum and bugle corps, which is kind of a marching band.
Yep.
And I was a soloist in there on the horn. And but you know, once that blues lead guitar bug bit me, there was no turning back. There really wasn't.
I realize we're taking a really big step now forward. You played with the likes of John Lee Hooker and Big Mama Thornton, but always as a sideman, always as a guitar player in the band, not as a leading musician in that band. Mm-hmm. Was that difficult for you?
That was not difficult at all. That was a lot of fun. You know, my first real gig as a sideman was for a guy named Louisiana Red, who still plays around. Yeah. And that was when I still lived in New Jersey, and I was, I think, 18. And we played around the East Coast. And it was just fun. Because when you're a sideman for these people, the pressure is not on you. The pressure's on the front guy.
Yeah.
You know? Like, for instance, when you're playing in John Mayall's band, people say, I went and heard John Mayall, you know, and that's where the focal point is, and it's Mr. Mayall who has the pressure on him to deliver a good show. Mm. When you're the side man, you stand up there behind the leader, and you play the music, and you have fun, and then when you get a chance to play a solo, you play it for everything you can play, you know, but being a sideman was really a lot of fun, and it was no problem at all.
But when you go and you did practice for a long time to make the blues, for as far as it's possible, your own. Now you go mm-hmm. playing with Louisiana Red and the likes of John Lee Hooker. They all have their own interpretation of the blues.
Sure.
And isn't that a problem for a white guy?
Well, you know, there's that whole thing of, you know, there's a school of thought that people go, well, white guys can't play the blues and all that. And I think that is just racist, because I believe that blues is just something that comes out of your soul and your feelings. And I believe anybody will have feelings they want to express.
What I mean is, John Lee Hooker never played a standard blues in his life.
No, he didn't. So what you do when you're a sideman for somebody like that, and this is how I approached all of those people, is when you get hired by them, you go out and you get their records, and you immerse yourself in their style, in their music, and you try to mold your playing to fit what you think is their vision and their interpretation of the music. Like with Big Mama Thornton, you don't get up and start playing Jimi Hendrix solos, you know? You try to fit into what she's doing, and that's your job. Your job is to back up that artist and help them, you know? Help you have to think in terms of the entire sound and the entire show, and you try to fit in with what it is they're doing. When I got hired by John Mayall, you know, I got the album he made with Eric Clapton and the albums he made with Mick Taylor, and I studied them. And so you don't go on and try to play like that, but you have a certain framework that you approach it with. Yeah. You know, you don't want to take it too far out. You want to fit into the band leader's vision.
Yeah, trying to read their musical autograph.
Yeah, trying to help them realize their interpretation of what they're doing. Try to help them and not get in their way. You want to work with them.
One of the great names from the blues in the 60s is Canned Heat. Fortunately, the band two times lost the frontman. You played with Canned Heat. How did that come about?
Well, I was playing in a band in Los Angeles of a guy named J.D. Nicholson. And J.D. Nicholson was a very old black piano player who had been with Little Walter and had played with a lot of the greats. He'd played with Freddie King. He played with a lot of really great people. And he had his own band, and we played around L.A. And I was the only white guy in the band, and I was the only guy under 60 years old. And at the time, I was like 27 or something. And we were playing at a club in Hermosa Beach called The Lighthouse, which is a very famous jazz club. It's been there for years and years, and everybody in jazz has played there. And we had a regular gig there, like every Tuesday night we played there. And one night, a couple members of Canned Heat came in and sat and listened to us. And the next night, they came back and they brought the manager of the band, and they approached me and said, "Look, we're going to do this tour of Australia, and we need a guitar player for the tour. Would you come do the tour with us?" And I said, "Sure, I'll go on tour." And it turned into almost 5 years. But by that time, I had already played with John Lee Hooker and Big Mama Thornton and Lowell Fulsom, Pee Wee Creighton, Percy Mayfield. I'd played with a lot of the really greats of
the big names
of the blues. Yeah, yeah.
How was that playing with the guys from Canned Heat? Because we always have the feeling that that was a bunch of blues purists.
No. They're purists in that they love the old school blues, but if you listen to their records, they've always taken that kind of country blues and presented it in sort of a modern way. All the way back to their first album, there was nothing purist about Henry Vestine's lead playing. He was the guy I replaced. Was the original lead player was Henry Vestine. And they actually just wanted me to do the tour because at the time Henry Vestine was drinking too much and he couldn't go on tour. But they were not really purists in the way they play it. They just loved listening to really old blues records. But we rocked in that band. We did a lot of rock and roll in that band.
After Canned Heat, Mr. John Mayall banged at your door.
Well, when I was in Canned Heat, we were hired to do three shows opening for John Mayall when he had reformed the original Blues Breakers with Mick Taylor, who went on, you know, to be in the Rolling Stones, and John McVie, who went on to be in Fleetwood Mac. And we did these three shows opening for those guys, and at the end of the three shows, John Mayall came to me and said, "I would like to hear you play second guitar to Mick Taylor. Do you want to go out on the road and do some shows with us?" And Canned Heat was taking some time off, so I found myself out on the road playing with the original Blues Breakers, which I had grown up listening to these guys, and it was an honor for me to be with these guys.
Doesn't that make you sweat all over the place? Because I think, well, you listen to a record and you play it about a period of Cream, just Eric Clapton played in the Blues Breakers, you listen, you go, wow, man, that's really good shit. And then you're all of a sudden you're there on the stage.
Yeah, it was, for a long time, it was kind of overwhelming to me.
Isn't it scary as well?
Yeah, it was a little scary, and it was a little, as I say, overwhelming, in that if I ever, like, when I was on the stage with those guys, if I really stopped and thought to myself, you know, a couple years ago, I lived in a little town in New Jersey and was having this dream of doing something with my guitar, and here I am playing with one of the Rolling Stones and one of Fleetwood Mac and John Mayall. I would suddenly get very nervous and, no, this can't be true. And I finally just had to accept it and go, you know what? This was your dream. Your dream is coming true. Enjoy the ride.
Yeah.
And don't get all caught up in the bull crap. Just enjoy this. This is your dream, man. Mm. And you've worked hard for it. Enjoy it.
Yeah. You were playing with Mick Taylor, and still as a hired hand, not as a full band member. Mm-hmm. When did you become a full band member?
About 6 months, 7 months later, John Mayall called me and said that he had disbanded the Mick Taylor, John McVie band, and that he wanted to start a new Blues Breakers with some L.A. musicians.
An all-American Blues Breakers.
All-American, L.A.-based Blues Breakers, and would I come and be a guitar player? And he hired me, and he hired Coco Montoya to be kind of dueling lead players.
Did that work out?
I'll tell you what, he got some very fiery, energetic shows, because it's taken Coco and I years to realize that John encouraged competition between he and I. He did it very subtly. He wasn't open about it, but he wanted the competition, and he wanted us to battle each other on stage to see who could outdo each other and get the most applause. And as a result, he got some very high energy, you know, fiery shows. But it also, you know, Coco and I for many years had a hard time with each other. When we were drinking a lot, we were fist fighting and throwing things at each other. And we've had to, over the years since we've both gone solo, we've had to sit down and have a talk and say, you know, that was a crazy time, and we're kind of glad that we're not doing that anymore.
But it also helped the careers of the both of you.
It helped both of us immensely, sure. Oh. If I hadn't have joined John's band, I don't know if I'd be sitting here with you right now. That was the stepping stone to my solo career.
Being in John Mayall's Blues Breakers, that's a well-known outfit. The next step was a solo career.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't that kind of frightening?
It was very frightening.
And how did it happen?
Well, I have to say that when I moved to California, when I was 23, you know, I packed my stuff into my Volkswagen. I had $150 and a couple of guitars and an amplifier. I drove to L.A. And my dream at that time was to have my own band, write songs, lead the band, do what I'm doing now. But I started getting all these gigs as a lead guitarist. And it was very cool just to go from one band to the other as a lead guitarist. But one day, you know, I started realizing here I am, I'm playing with John Mayall. And as far as in the blues world of being a sideman, you're not really, there's nowhere to go from there to go up.
Yeah.
Where else are you going to go? Who are you going to play with? That's about as respected and, you know, great a position as you're going to achieve as a sideman.
Hmm.
There's nowhere to go from there but down, really. You could go get in B.B. King's band, probably, but you wouldn't get to play solos. Or do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, you'd still be be a great guitar player, but be a guitar player in the band of...
Yeah, and that's as high success-wise as a sideman as you're going to get in the blues. So it started dawning on me that I was either going to stay there in that band for the rest of my life, or I was going to have to make a move and do something on my own and try to chase my original dream, which was to be Walter Trout and to write songs and sing them and have my own band.
But that also meant that you have to start from scratch again.
I had to start from scratch, and I had to quit and take the gamble. And I made the decision to leave his band on my 38th birthday in Gothenburg, Sweden. We were playing in a big symphony orchestra hall. And I was standing up there playing, and I was going, I'm in this huge, beautiful concert hall, and I'm playing with, you know, one of the greats of the blues here.
Making good money, probably.
Making really good money and staying in nice hotels, and you know. But I'm 38, and if I ever want to have my own career and do something on my own, the chance is going to pass me by soon if I don't make the move. And it's my 38th birthday, and by the time I'm 40, I want to say to myself, I've got a solo career. I have a band. I'm establishing myself. So I went to John's room that night on my birthday and sat down and told him, I'm going to have to leave your band. And, you know, I cried. He's like a father to me. And it was very emotional. And, you know, he was great about it, but he said, you know, oh, you'll feel different tomorrow. You're just emotional because it's your birthday. And I said, you know, I am emotional because it's my birthday, but I'm not going to feel different tomorrow. And told him, I'll finish this tour, and then I'm going to go on my own. And one thing he said, man, I wish you all the best. I've had a lot of people go through my bands that have gone on. He goes, but one thing you need to know, if you quit now, don't call me in a year and say, John, it hasn't worked, I've made a mistake, I want to come back. You can't come back.
He never did that.
Huh?
He never did that, John Mayall, take musicians back in his band.
Well, no, you know, that's what he told me. Mm. I mean, I know he just made a DVD with Eric Clapton. That's a different thing. That's not rehiring the guy. He said, you know, when you leave, I'll find another guitar player who isn't very well known, and I'll make him known, and it'll be his time in my band. So you better really think about this, because once you leave, you're gone. We'll still be friends. It'll be great to see you, but I'm going to move on with my band after you leave, and don't call me up in a year and say I want to come back.
But you never did.
I never did.
No. What happened then? You started to find your own band. Where did you get those people from?
Well, for many years, when I was in Canned Heat and playing with Hooker and with Mayall, whenever I was not on tour, I would go down to a little bar in the town I live in, and I would jam with my friends. And we would play 5 hours a night, and we'd play everything from Beatles songs to Led Zeppelin to Count Basie songs to country music to Creedence Clearwater and anything we knew. We just played for fun. And it's a little bar at the beach. And it was called the Walter Trout Band. And when I quit, John, I just called my friends that jammed with me at the bar. And they became the Walter Trout Band, and one of them is still with me, Jimmy Trapp, the bass player.
What does the change of being just a musician into being a band leader, how did that feel to you? Because it's a lot of more responsibility besides playing good music and having the songs ready. You're also a kind of a manager then.
Yeah, you're a manager. You're a babysitter. You know.
Were you ready for that?
I had to get ready very quickly. And it's been a learning experience, and it still is. One of the ways that I was lucky in that I had 5 years to observe Mr. Mayall, who is so great at being a band leader.
That's the ultimate band leader.
Yeah, and one of the things I learned watching him is being a band leader is a talent unto itself. Mm. Duke Ellington was a great band leader. You know, John Mayall is a great band leader.
How about Walter Trout?
You'd have to ask my band, you know, but I think I'm doing pretty good with them. And but I got to watch John and observe how he does things. And I have to say, in many ways, the way I run my band, I do imitate it, some of his techniques of running a band. You know, sometimes you also have to be a psychiatrist, you have to be a psychologist, you have to be a babysitter, you have to be a manager, and you still have to get up every night and be the focal point. Now the pressure's on me. You know, the guys in my band are the sidemen, and if I have a rotten show, people say, I went to see Walter Trout, and it wasn't very good. They don't mention the bass player or the keyboard player. It's on me now. But I was prepared to take that on because there's also greater rewards. You work harder, but you get to play your own music, and I get to play as much guitar as I can stand. You know, I love John Mayall, but when I was in his band, I would maybe get to play 3 or 4 solos in a night, and I'd go back to my hotel and I'd be like, when do I want to play, man? I spent my whole youth practicing this instrument. I want to play this thing. I don't want to do 3 solos, you know. And in my own band, I can play the guitar until I fall over and nobody can tell me to stop, you know, and that's the reward.
You told me that Denmark was your first European. How did you tell? Denmark was like really good for you.
Well, I sort of started my solo career in Denmark, and that is because on the tour that I quit, John, a couple weeks earlier, before my birthday, we had been in Denmark. John Mayall had gotten very sick with the flu. And in a town called Aalborg, Denmark, he had decided he was going to cancel the show. And the promoter said, if you cancel the show, I'm going to lose a lot of money. How about if the band goes on without you, and at the end of the night, I say anybody wants their money back can have their money back. And John agreed to it. So we went on that night. John stayed at the hotel, and myself and Coco Montoya took turns leading the band and singing, and we just played all kinds of stuff. I remember getting up that night and doing Hey Joe by Jimi Hendrix and Red House and just playing all kinds of stuff, and it turned out to be a great show, and in the audience happened to be a guy from a Danish record label, and he came backstage and said, I would like you to make your own record. And when he said that, the promoter said, if you make your own record, I'll book a tour for you in Denmark. So I sort of had this opportunity presented to me to make a record and do a tour, even though it was in a tiny little country. It was a start. So that also played into my decision to quit John, was I had this offer on the table that I could make a record, do a tour. So I made my first album for a small Danish record label and started touring in Denmark constantly. I was there all the time. And it's a small country, but I'd be there for months at a time playing in every little tiny bar around that country. And I met a Danish girl there, fell in love with her and married her and brought her back to America. And she still says to me that when she met me, we were known as the house band of Denmark. And so that was really where it started for me, and I do have a special feeling in my heart for that country.
Yeah, yeah. The first record that I got hold of you from the Walter Child Band was the live one from Roskilde.
It was from Midfin Festival.
Midfin. The inlay, it says Roskilde.
No, Midfins.
Midfins?
Yeah, Life in the Jungle.
Life in the Jungle.
Midfins Festival. And that fold-out inside, that's from Midfins Festival.
Mm-hmm. You once told me that during that period, actually for most of the time, you didn't know where you were.
How do you mean?
Like being on the road all that time. You told me many years ago, all the time being on the road kind of changed you as a person. Not being focused, but being like other people lived your life.
Well, you know, going on the road for months on end is something you need to learn how to deal with. Mm-hmm. And it is a tough life. You don't get a lot of sleep. You eat bad food. You have nothing really to hold on to. You're in a different city every day. Sometimes you're not even aware of what country you're in, because it can be one country to the next day by day. And after a few months of that, you can sort of lose. You don't have your feet on the ground anymore. You lose your focus in your life. It just becomes you sit in a bus or a hotel, or you're on stage. And you have to learn how to deal with it and keep it in the proper perspective. And a lot of musicians don't, and that's how they end up, I think, kind of screwed up on drink and drugs and stuff, is as you lose your grounding, you know, you're just out in space, and you do lose a certain part of yourself. But I find now, if you keep it in the proper frame of mind, it can actually help you grow as a person. You get a lot of experiences out there, a lot of input, you meet a lot of people, and you keep your head in the right place, you can come out of it a better person instead of a screwed up crazy person. You know,
off the record, we talked about in Hilversum a long time ago about you meeting Santana, Carlos Santana, but you don't want to talk about it on air now.
I don't mind talking about that. No.
That was what I was referring to.
Yeah, well, I was with John Mayall, and we were in East Berlin back when it was communist, because we used to play in East Germany and behind the Iron Curtain quite a bit. And I was a stone alcoholic drug addict. And Carlos Santana came to a show. He was there in East Berlin with his band. And he came backstage after the show and basically said to me, I don't know, you know, this is not America. I don't know if I can say this, but he basically said, man, you're an asshole. And you can edit that if you need to.
No, we don't.
Okay.
This is Holland.
And I said, like, what? you know, what's your problem, you know? And he goes, you're in one of the top blues bands in the world. And he says, there's 100,000 guitar players out there who would give anything to be in Mayall's band. And here you are. You got the slot. And God touched you, and he gave you a gift to play the guitar. And you're so drunk up there. You're playing sloppy. You're playing like shit. You have it in you to be great. You have the gift. But you're telling God, you know, fuck off. And you need to think about what you're doing, and you need to examine your life. And he spent 3 days with me in this hotel, hanging out, talking about life. He gave me a book to read, which was basically a religious book, but it was really about examining yourself to find your potential and whatever talents and abilities you have, and then working your hardest to develop your potential and go as far as you can in your life and be serious about your life and not be just a clown. And after 3 days with him and reading this book, I went to John and I said, you will never see me drunk on stage again. And I stopped drinking and drugging right then. And it's been 18 years.
You were kind of like a born-again Christian.
Kind of. That's you know, that's part of it. The other part is, you know, I had a revelation right around that same time, too, and that was I sort of felt that God spoke to me, and he said, if you will show me the strength and the conviction to change your life, get off of drugs, get off of alcohol, approach your music seriously, I will give you the desire of your heart. I will give you what you need and what you want in your life. So I quit. He gave me a career and a beautiful wife and family. So I can't ignore that kind of thing. I consider that a miracle. And when miracles happen to you, it's hard to ignore. So when anybody gets on to me about religion, I go, look, this isn't some crazy thing, and I don't go around and preach to anybody. Mm. I keep it to myself, but I've experienced it, and I'm talking out of my experience. I receive that message. You do this for me, I'll do this for you. And there it is, you know. I can't ignore that.
It almost sounds like a song from Robert Johnson, Crossroads, but the devil is replaced with God.
Yeah, sure. Sometime, if you ever meet B.B. King, ask him about this whole myth of blues being the devil's music, and he gets really mad at that.
Oh, we don't want to piss off old B.B.
No, we don't. But he thinks that's a crock of shit, you know.
At a certain point in your career, and that's not very long ago, you lost the use of your left arm.
Yeah, I did.
How did it happen?
I had an injury. I mean, it's a long story what happened, but I had an injury in my upper back, in my left shoulder, and it got worse and worse. And right around the time of the injury, my wife was scheduled to give birth to our second son. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really tell her that I was injured and that my arm was having problems. And when it was time for her to give birth to the baby, she wanted to squat on her knees. And I got behind her and I held her up. And I literally held her up, her whole body, as she delivered the baby. And that did it. It completely destroyed the muscles and the tendons in my shoulder and my arm was completely dead. I couldn't lift a glass. I couldn't move my fingers.
That's a catastrophe.
And, you know, I had to I had to tell her right after the birth of our boy there, I'm 50 years old, we got a house, we got some kids, and I can't work anymore. And I had to cancel a lot of work in America. I couldn't play the guitar anymore. I was out, you know, trying to get a job at Starbucks to try to pay the rent. And, you know, I'm in Starbucks coffee. Asking for a job and trying to explain to them that I was used to be a famous guitar player. And so they thought I was nuts and told me to get out. But basically, I had to get a lot of therapy and do a lot of work. And I had to teach myself to play again. And it took me months and months where I couldn't work. I had to tell my band, you're gone, go do something else. And but I did the work, and I ended up having to start over, practice 8 hours a day. I remember sitting with my wife and actually playing a G chord and saying, wow, that's a G chord. And we both danced around the house. I can play a G chord, you know. It was a big deal. And I actually came out of it, though, I think, a better guitar player. Because to be that age and to suddenly put that amount of work back into it, once I got the use of my fingers back, it had opened up a lot of areas in my mind musically that I didn't know were there before. So I came out of it a better player than I was before it happened, I think.
All right. Now, you're playing again, and there's a new album coming out very soon, and it's a compilation. Can you tell me something about that?
Well, it's kind of a look back. It's a lot of my earlier recordings, and I think it's some songs of mine that I think, you know, can stand to be listened to again, and I think are sort of forgotten songs, and I'd like people to give them another listen. And it's sort of a retrospective of my career over the years, but really from the beginning. There's going to be a cut on there from my band I had in New Jersey when I'm 20 years old. There's a cut of us playing in a little coffee house in New Jersey to five people, playing a slow blues. And there's one track of me as a studio musician where I play lead on a song by a guy named Freebo, who used to play bass with Bonnie Raitt for years and years, and he's played with Bruce Springsteen and Roy Buchanan and many people. But he did a solo album, and I played lead. And there's a cut from there that was not released. And there's also some acoustic stuff I did with my old piano player Martin Gershwitz. So it's just a look back, really. It's sort of where did I come from, and when I started off doing this, it's a sort of a view of those years.
A rear view mirror.
Yeah, there you go.
Kind of album. We know where you came from because you told us. Where are you going to?
Oh, boy. Hopefully I will just be able to keep doing this for many, many years. You know, I don't take it for granted anymore after what happened to me with my arm. I know that any time I get up and play, that it might be my last time. So I try to play like this is my final statement on how I felt to be alive. Where I'm going, I hope, is just to keep playing music for people and writing songs, and also try to be a good husband and a good father, and just keep doing what I'm doing. And, you know, I would like to find myself some time in the future like John Lee Hooker was, where he's 85 and he's still playing shows. Maybe he had to sit down, and maybe he could only play for a half an hour, but he was still playing shows 3 days before he died. And that, to me, would be great. I don't want to retire. Somebody asked me yesterday, well, do you see yourself stopping this in 10 years? And I go, well, what would I do?
What the fuck for?
What do I do? Go fishing or, you know, no. This is not something I want to stop doing. You know, it's my passion in life. It's my joy. It's my self-expression. It's who I am.
It's in your veins.
Yeah. And I have to do it or I go nuts.
We had the possibility to see you last December, the beginning of last December. We're, well, it's January now. Will there be a Walter Trout performance in Holland in the year 2005?
Yes, I will be back in, I believe, October or November. They're just starting to book it now. And so I'll be back to do my normal five or six shows next year.
And play the fuck out of those Dutchmen.
Well, the audiences here are just the greatest in the world. I'm telling you, when we got back here the other night and did our first show, we came off stage and went, wow, it is just great to be back in the Netherlands because the audiences are so enthusiastic and they get so involved in what you're doing. And it really becomes, for those 2 hours, it's like it's a big community, you know?
Walter Trout, it was a privilege having you here.
Well, it's great. Thank you for inviting me here. Thanks a lot.